Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of that war's most courageous, vigorous, and intrepid observers, analysts, and commentators, well, and actually combatants for that matter, is our first guest, Diana West. We have the privilege of speaking with her each week about now. She is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist. She blogs at dianawest.net. You can also find her writings in two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Frank. Wonderful to be with you.
Well, I wanted to start to get your sense, Diana, of what we should make of the latest mayhem in Las Vegas, the murderous attack by a peculiar individual, as best we can tell. We are insistently assured that while we don't know what his motivations were, they weren't terrorism. Walk me through what we do know and how that could possibly be. If we don't know what his motivations are, that they are definitely not terrorism.
Yes, well, this is an attempt to control the narrative before the narrative can even be understood, which is extremely dangerous. It is absolutely irresponsible of authorities to make these kinds of sweeping statements. It doesn't help us. It doesn't secure the information we need. It doesn't keep people on the alert. It doesn't do public service. We still have a couple of ISIS statements, official statements from ISIS, as official as they can be, that do claim this individual as a soldier of Allah in varying degrees, including an Arabic name. This has to be a piece of the puzzle that good investigators weigh, just as there are reports, we don't have them confirmed in a public sense, but reports of Antifa literature in his rooms. We don't know if that's true, but to actually make this kind of statement that there is no terrorist motivation, when indeed the act in and of itself is whatever ideology, whatever motivation, it is terrorism incarnate to create such fear, carnage, death, destruction, and tearing its social fabric. It is indeed terrorism.
You know, Diana, one other data point, which I have had relayed to me, I don't know if it's true, but I believe it is. The source was impeccable. And that is that the Islamic State had, before this attack, put out a notice that in response to the increasing pressure they're under, the rolling up of their operations in Syria and Iraq, in part at our hands, that they are going to attack us here at home, going after places where large numbers of people gather and essentially serving notice on us, warning us that that is going to be forthcoming. Again, just a data point, but it infuriates me when I hear people persist, as you say, in sort of this narrative manipulation at a moment when, if anything, we need people to be more alert, more conscious of this, seeing, saying something and all that. Let me just ask you in that regard, Diana, we're increasingly confronting what seems to me, one of my colleagues has called it unrestricted warfare against freedom of speech. And in a way, this is of a piece with that, trying to, you know, discourage discussion of the possibility that there may be a Sharia supremacist connection, for example, to this attack. We don't know that, but even discussing it is considered to be impolitic, shall we say. You're looking at this closely, Diana. You've been watching what's been happening in Europe as well as here. Talk a little bit about the extent to which we are now, in effect, submitting, whether it's described as multiculturalism or political correctness or Sharia blasphemy, for that matter, to real restrictions on freedom of speech and what that portends for our republic.
Well, it's something that's been part of our lives for since 9/11, certainly. From the very start, there has been this tremendous pressure not to examine, not to study, not to understand, not to analyze, not just Islam, but also the state of Islamic immigration, the cycles of Islamic immigration and expansionism across the centuries, not to understand the eradication of host nations that accept or are invaded by Islam across centuries. We have been essentially asked to negate our own logic, curiosity, and indeed survival instinct, situational awareness in service of this narrative manipulation, ideological manipulation. But essentially what it's all about is power and control. And that is the antithesis of any kind of functioning republic. When an elite group, whether it's in media, government, in the institutions, the academia, when they control essentially your spoken word, your written word, and at a certain point, as I've been studying and writing about for many years now, and you as well, when they're controlling your thoughts, and this takes us back to, of course, in popular terms, this takes us back to George Orwell, in Made Manifest, if that's the right word, when they control your thoughts, the game is over. And this is indeed where so much of our population is. And that's why I think authorities can actually come to a microphone where before bodies have been collected and wounds have been dressed and actually state there's no terrorism connection. And many people will heed that. And that's where it gets very dangerous, when the people become sheep.
Yeah, and sheeple, as they call them. We're looking at this in a number of different respects, of course, and I'm concerned particularly that in the aftermath of this incident in Charlottesville, that the Congress of the United States and the President of the United States have been buffaloed into buying into this whole idea that we can't have hate speech. There's no room for haters. And this is certainly no endorsement of white supremacists or any other kind of supremacists for that matter. But it is to say, we need to be able to talk about these things. And it isn't hate speech to do it if what you're doing is factually describing and warning about the threats to our freedoms, including most especially our freedom of speech, which is, I think, foundational in the process. Diana, let me switch gears. Our mutual friend, Stephen Bannon, and man, I frankly do not admire very much, though he is lionized by lots of other people. Henry Kissinger seemed to be making common cause for what I have to say sounds like a good cause, warning about communist China and what it's up to. Henry Kissinger, of course, has done as much as anybody on the planet to embolden and empower communist China. So his warnings come as often these things do from him. As perhaps nothing more than guilt, but it is interesting, isn't it? And what do you think would be the upshot of such a joint effort on their part?
Well, I what will be the mechanism of power of such a joint effort? We don't know how this translates into anything outside of PR. However, I think that it is something that Steve Bannon does at his to his own peril. Henry Kissinger is the preeminent globalist in the world. Stephen Bannon has come to prominence as one of the spokesmen of America First. Henry Kissinger has created a web, an organization, an international globalist organization over many decades in public and private life. And the idea that Stephen Bannon can walk in and have it serve America's interests is frankly ridiculous. I mean, this to me is not so much serving common cause. This to me looks like co-opting a good cause.
Let's reserve judgment till we see what they say, I think, in fairness to Steve. But look, a warning about communist China from any quarter, it seems to me, is a good thing. But I think there is a danger here. Anytime you're dealing with Henry Kissinger, the kinds of conniving and service to our enemies that he has rendered over the years is not to be underestimated. Diana, we have to leave it at that provocative note. We will talk with you again next week, I hope, and thank you very much for your time today. As always, it's really great talking with you, and I look forward to our next chat. Next up, we'll talk with Luis Fleischman. We'll get an update on Latin America, Venezuela, Cuba, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Dr. Luis Fleischman. These days, he is a senior advisor to the Menges Hemispheric Security Project at our Center for Security Policy. He edits the Americas Report for us. He contributes mightily to the public policy debate, notably through his writings in places like Newsmax. We'll be speaking with him about one of those recent pieces. Also, his latest book is Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, The Security Threat to the United States. Luis Fleischman, welcome back. So good to have you.
Good to be here with you always, Frank.
Luis Fleischman, let me ask you first, we have not spoken since President Trump quite elegantly filleted the government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela in the course of his speech to the United Nations. I wondered about your takeaway from his comment that this was not a case of the failure to implement socialism effectively that has bankrupted that country and put its people in such desperate privation, but it actually was the faithful implementation of socialism that has done that. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, I think it is the Venezuelan regime that was inaugurated by and founded by Hugo Chavez definitely had a lot of elements of socialism, like expropriation of private property, even though they also benefited people that were close to the regime. A lot of people became wealthy, not as a result of their productivity, but as a result of basically being close to the regime and supporting the regime. But definitely there was something very similar to communism in so far as the government took over the monopoly of the economy, eliminated, basically the private sector had no reason to be in business, or it was nationalized directly. Therefore, at this point is when scarcity began to take place. And the reason why scarcity began to take place is because if the person that distributes the milk or the farmers that produce the products have no reason to be in business, that produces scarcity. And the same happened, by the way, in the communist countries in Eastern Europe and all over the world, that communism couldn't get productivity. And definitely the Marxist socialist regime, the communist regime, state-oriented, is basically leads by definition to this kind of situation because it eliminates the creative energies and the freedom of people to produce. And therefore, if there is no production, eventually it leads to scarcity, and in the case of Venezuela, almost to starvation. And the same happened also in Eastern Europe, by the way.
Yeah. No, you're so right. This is something that we had thought had been not only well documented, but proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. And yet we have the likes of Bernie Sanders and a lot of young people in this country still enamored of this totally futile exercise in abusive political arrangements. Let me ask you about Maduro, the successor to Hugo Chavez, Luis Fleischman, now on apparently a world tour of some of the same countries that have been wrecked by this socialist enterprise, notably Russia and Belarus. He's also going to hit Turkey, apparently. I'm wondering whether while he's in the neighborhood, he might also slip over to see his allies in Iran. But is there any chance that while he's out and about, the people of Venezuela can keep him out of that country and begin the process of change that's so desperately and so clearly needed there?
Well, I think it is a wonderful idea, Frank, and just to keep him out. But I think he has enough people around that still the security apparatus is in his hands, and this is why he has been able to survive these rebellions, these uprisings.
A Cuban-led security apparatus at that, let's not forget.
That's correct, and the security apparatus is supported by the Cubans. So I doubt that will happen, but I don't think it is a bad idea.
Yeah, the pass it on, as they say. While we're talking about Cuba, Luis Fleischman, let me ask you, the U.S. government is now sufficiently angry over what has been done by presumably the Cubans, or at least with their knowledge, to a number of our diplomats, including, it is reported, impairment of their brains, in fact, through some kind of sonic blasting, it's believed. We've now expelled 15 of their diplomats. Where do things stand with the Cuban government as you see it, and what should we be doing beyond this expulsion?
Well, I think it is. I think what we are seeing that is good in this policy is the fact that very much contrary to what Barack Obama did in terms of trying to think that the relations with a not normal country such as Cuba is going to be normal. This acoustic attack, I would say, on Cuban diplomats is a sign of that the Cubans are not reliable partners. The Cubans continue to support the Venezuelan government. The Cubans continue to imprison their people. The Cubans continue to take an anti-American stand in international forums.
And engaged in intelligence collection against us. We could go on and on. But the point is that this is not a relationship that is improving, that is ameliorating the behavior of the Cuban government any more than the Obama bomb deal with Iran.
It is improving only on our side. I mean, we have gotten nothing from the Cubans, nothing. And so I think to toughen the position toward Cuba, I think it is a good idea, in the same way that to toughen the position toward Iran, it is a good idea. I'm not suggesting necessarily that we need to reverse the situation with Cuba totally, but at least to show that, we are not going to be naive about them at all.
Yeah. Well, look, I think anything short of a total reversal is suggesting otherwise, that we are somewhat naive. Luis, let me just leave with a final question. We have had in recent days, of course, an important referendum in the northern part of Iraq where the Kurds have sought freedom from the rest of the country. In Newsmax, you've written that they are our allies, and I gather we should support them, in your view. Talk a little bit about that quickly, if you would.
Absolutely. First of all, the Kurds have been extremely helpful to us strategically, not only in defeating ISIS. The major military victories we had against ISIS were thanks to the Kurds. Secondly, the Kurds have been a strategic threat to Iran as well. Remember, Iran tends to achieve hegemony in the Middle East. And having a Kurdish state right there is going to be like another element that counterbalances the ambitions of Iran, particularly in Iraq. Therefore, I think we need to support Kurdish independence. And in addition, one thing that I have noticed and we have noticed is that the Iraqi government, even though Maliki is no longer there, they tend to make easily alliances with Iran. Partly, obviously, because this is a Shiite type of rule, and Iran supports Shiite rule in Iraq. And that's what they've raised to ISIS, because they alienated the Sunnis, undermining the work done under the Bush administration of basically getting the Sunnis on the side, on the right side. The Iraqi government at this point is not reliable. And I think the United States needs to stand its ground and say to the Iraqi government, any alliance with Iran is unacceptable, and to punish Turkey if necessary, if they boycott the Kurds.
We will be watching closely whether the Kurds pull this off, as well as perhaps inspire ethnic Kurds in other parts of that region, Turkey, Syria, Iran notably, to join them, which could shake things up quite dramatically in the face of the Iranian project for, as you say, Luis Fleischman, hegemony in the region. That and more we'll be discussing in the days ahead. We look forward to doing so with you. Thank you so much for your time today. Dr. Luis Fleischman, come back to us again very soon. Next up, Dr. Herbert London on the shape of the red-green axis and its assault on our freedoms, and also what's going on in Catalonia. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Herbert London, the president and founder of the London Center for Policy Research. He is a man who has been making incredibly important contributions in both the public and private sector for a long time, in academia, as well as in the world of think tanks, as a candidate for office, and as an incredibly prolific author. I am deeply grateful to him for having been something of a mentor to me and teaching me much about the world in which we live, as he has so many others. It's wonderful to have him with us for what I hope will be the first of several conversations, including a full hour-length one in the near future. Dr. London, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. My friend, it's so good to have you.
Well, Frank, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. And if anyone is mentoring anyone, I'm being mentored by you. So thank you very much for that kind words.
Kind of you to say. A mutual admiration society. So, Herb, one of the things on which we violently agree is that there is a phenomenon at work at the moment in this country, as well as elsewhere, that forges a most unlikely, it would seem, alliance between the radical left on the one hand and Islamists, or if you will, Sharia supremacists, as our friend Andy McCarthy calls them. You've described this as a watermelon alliance. Others of us have been describing it as a red-green axis. Talk about what it is, how would these seemingly diametrically opposed types have come together, and to what end?
Well, I think that what you see here in this red-green alliance, the reason why I call it the Watermelon Alliance, is in fact the desire on the part of both the extreme left and, of course, Muslims, come together largely because of their antipathy to the United States and the policies of the West. The desire here is to try and undermine the West, even though you would think on its face these people have very little in common. Clearly, if you were to cite one example, the desire to maintain the interests of homosexuals might be the view of the left, certainly not the view of Muslims. But nonetheless, they come together in part because of the, as I've suggested, there are great concerns about the role that the West has played in world history and the desire to undermine the character and the principles that undermine that characterize the West today.
Yeah. In a really interesting and characteristically thoughtful piece that you had at, I believe, WAMC.org, you describe a piece of this that I think is particularly alarming. You know, a lot of attention is paid at the moment to Antifa and, of course, to the violence of the assorted jihadists. And yet you argue, I think properly, Herb London, that we are also facing a more stealthy, pre-violent kind of insurgency here. Civilization jihad is a term the Muslim Brotherhood has used for it. Tease that out for us as well, if you would.
Well, I think that what you're seeing here, described as lawfare, is an attempt to use the use of the institutions of the West to undermine the West. The Constitution, for example, and the First Amendment is used to undermine the Constitution. The idea that you have free speech and that you can use speech as a way of influencing opinion is also a desire on the part of those who have a clear motive to change the character of the West, to use the institutions that we presently have in order to undermine them. And that is one of the ways in which lawfare often works. And it works in a way that I think has a kind of nefarious effect on the society. We often overlook this in part because this isn't violent behavior or not seemingly violent behavior, but it obviously is a prelude to what might be violent behavior.
And there are so many other examples of it, too. You know, the march through the institutions of the left, you've experienced this firsthand in your many years in academia, Herb London, but also through our courts, through the business sector, notably Occupy Wall Street and Sharia-compliant finance. And, of course, not least through our government with efforts to subvert it or induce it to conform to these agendas. The role of freedom of speech is so vital. As you say, it's a constitutional right. It's being abused to some extent by some who would take down this country, but it's also being abused in another way. And I'd like you to think about this with us, if you would. The extent to which groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, the Anti-Defamation League, another example, and so many others, are now seeking to suppress the speech of those they don't agree with.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, a very interesting point, because what you have here are those who will stand by the Muslim society, or at least organizations like CARE, and support CARE, and at the same time, not recognize the fact that CARE is doing everything in its power to change our culture and to change the society.
Right. This, of course, is the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas front.
It's a Hamas front. And as you may remember, in the Homeland case, it was obviously a co-conspirator, an unindicted co-conspirator. So what we're talking about here are organizations like that that play a very significant role in our society. And by and large, you have the Southern Poverty Legal Group standing by them and also making accusations about others that they do not agree with. I mean, it's remarkable, for example, that Ayaan Hirsi Ali is described as an extremist. An extremist because she's opposed to honor killings, an extremist because she believes Islamists in our society want to undermine the society, and she's an extremist because she is very much opposed to the idea that there should not be arranged marriages.
It's an effort to make sure that people who are effectively opposing their agenda are silenced, first and foremost, it seems to me.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, when you talk about organizations like, you may not agree with a Family Research Council, but this is a perfectly legitimate organization deeply concerned about conservative principles. And again, you may not agree, but to describe this organization as an extremist group.
Haters and bigots and racists. No, I couldn't agree more. But they describe us that way too, Hank, Herb, as you know.
Well, I mean, look, you've been described that way many times, Frank. But, the fact is that here you are defending the principles of the West, standing by our constitutional understandings and saying that, you care deeply about the best interests of the United States and you're described as an extremist. This is remarkable.
It's about freedom. At the end of the day, that's what we're all about. Herb, as I know you are, let me ask you to talk quickly about another subject that you're thinking about, and that is what's going on in Catalonia, a province in Spain that just recently had a referendum, which apparently, despite the efforts of the government of Spain to block it, an overwhelming majority said, we want out of here. We want independence, self-determination. What's that about, and what are the implications?
One of the reasons for that, I believe, is that what you're seeing in Spain is what might be described as a kind of neo-Westphalian revival. That is the revival of the idea of the state, the notion that somehow we're going to have this kind of post-state arrangement of the kind that you've seen in Europe is obviously not on the cards. The notion of the last administration for a kind of world globalism where we come together, or the new world order that Bush talked about, is not in the cards. The European Union being a kind of classic example of this, but what you're seeing in Spain, which I regard as very interesting, 20% of Spain today is Muslim. It is increasing at the rate of roughly 27% a year. The desire on the part of Muslims to reacquire territory they once had is obviously in the cards. If you go to Costa del Sol, it's now an extension of Saudi Arabia. Every yacht in the marina is a Saudi yacht. I mean, there is no doubt that what we're seeing in Spain today is a clear example of the reacquisition of much of the territory that the Moors once had. And in that sense, this scenario, which is a kind of bot your scenario of a kind of Arabia, is something that we're seeing before our very eyes. We're seeing it in Spain. And it strikes me, this is a very alarming development. It's happening in Spain. It will happen elsewhere. But there is no doubt that Spain represents the kind of thin edge of the wedge, the beginning of a very important development that's occurring in Europe. The Catalonians saying, we don't want any part of this. Our economy is doing a lot better than the economy of the rest of Spain, which is faltering. Well, our economy is an economy that appears to have fewer Muslims and much less welfareism than you have in the rest of Spain. So the Catalonians are saying, we're out of here. We don't want any part of this. And it's an understandable reaction.
Yeah, it seems to me it's in our interest to have them do so. So I'm looking forward to further conversations about that and about the Kurds as well. We were discussing them a moment ago with Louise Fleischman. I'm anxious to pick your brains about that subject too. Herb London, that's it for today, though. Thank you so much for joining us and for the terrific work you do at the London Center for Policy Research. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Ann Corcoran, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, I'm very pleased to say, by a remarkable woman who has been, by nothing but sheer force of will, transformed from a regular citizen of this country into one of America's foremost experts on the challenges posed to our, well, our security, as well as the demographics and political makeup of our country, by the phenomenon known as refugee resettlement. Her name is Ann Corcoran. She is a blogger at Refugee Resettlement Watch. She is also the author of a terrific monograph that we published at the Center for Security Policy entitled Refugee Resettlement and the Hydra to America. She did an accompanying video which has, at last count, almost 3 million views, which is no mean feat since it's all by word of mouth. It speaks to the concern many of us feel about what's being done in our country as well as in Europe and elsewhere. And it's so great to have a chance to visit with her. Ann Corcoran, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Frank.
As we speak, Ann, there is a sort of microcosmic example of what you have been warning about for some 10 years now, involving refugees that were initially supposed to go to Australia, but the Aussies decided they didn't want them, and they're now headed here. Donald Trump has called this a dumb deal that Barack Obama arranged to do that with the Australian government. So why is he allowing this to happen, and what are the implications of doing so?
First, let me say very clearly, these aren't even refugees. These are illegal aliens who attempted to get to Australia by boat. And in 2013, the Australian government said, anybody who tries to break into our country illegally by boat, you're going to detention center. So that's exactly what they did. These are mostly men, mostly single men. 1,250 of them, in fact, are being considered for resettlement in the United States. They are on offshore islands at the moment. Trump said when he came in, this is a dumb deal. Obama set it up in September of 2016. And Trump now is going along with this idea of taking these illegal, they are really truly illegal alien men from mostly Muslim countries to the United States.
What could possibly go wrong with that? One has to ask. Military age young men, for example, unaccompanied from mostly Muslim countries. I don't see any problem with that. Do you, Anne?
And to top it off, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees went to visit these two detention centers and found that the percentage of mental health problems was 80%, above 80% for both groups on both islands. So they have mental issues. They were going to come here needing mental health treatment, mostly single men, the vast majority, who have been some in detention for 4 years. And as some people have said to me, you're going to have some mental issues if you're a man who's been in detention for 4 years. And they, when they get to the United States, it's just mind-boggling. They literally are free. They will be placed in one of five states, or in five states now. We know which states: Georgia, Oregon, Colorado, Texas, and Arizona are the first places they will be going. But people don't understand. Refugees come into the United States. They are free people. They will be placed by a resettlement contracting agency.
As I recall, Ann Corcoran, this is how you got into this whole business, is that somebody did a similar stunt in your community out in Western Maryland. This is crazy making that we're seeing this done now across America. I am also given to understand by you, among others, I think, that the first thing that these so-called voluntary agencies, the sort of cottage industry of refugee resettlement or HIDRA enabling, HIDRA being that migration and colonization that Muslims are supposed to engage in, the first thing they do after settling this first batch is that they go get their relatives. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. They can bring in the relatives shortly thereafter. I mean, it just never ends. And these agencies, which are mostly supposedly religious organizations, supposedly nonprofit, are literally paid by the head to resettle refugees. So in my mind, if these agencies could be removed from the system, we would solve many of our problems. There's no incentive to ever slow this flow as long as they're paid by the head.
To the contrary, there's a powerful incentive to keep it going, and they lobby intensively for that purpose. And you mentioned this religious complexion to it. Could you give us a sense of the magnitude of the impact, the money that, say, the Catholic charities are obtaining through serving as a refugee resettlement voluntary agency towards the bottom line of, say, the Catholic bishops?
Catholic charities in some parts of the country are getting additional federal money going directly to them through a diocese and not through the bishops. But the bishops a year ago got just short of $100 million for their migration fund, which is dealing with the DACA children, unaccompanied alien minors, and the refugees.
Do you have any sense of what a percentage of their overall budget that would represent? That's a staggeringly large number.
Oh, of their migration fund? Now, the only thing we really have a handle on is what they call their migration program or their migration fund. It's about 98% of the funds that they receive for migration. They only get about 2% from donations from, you know, passing the plate on Sundays.
But this is a prime example of why there is such an emphasis placed by these guys on continuing the flow of these refugees, even though, for heaven's sakes, there isn't a one of these religious orders or faiths that is going to last a minute if these turn out to be Islamists and if they have their way in terms of these other faiths. I was just talking with Herb London in the previous segment, Anne, about the red-green axis, people who care about feminists or their agenda or homosexuals or Jews. I mean, what are they thinking when they're bringing it to bear the purposes of these Sharia supremacists? It's crazy-making.
Right. The Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society is a prime example. It is one of the nine contractors that narrowly is bringing in. Hardly any Jews anymore come into the country as refugees. It's a tiny, tiny number. So they've moved on to Muslims.
And very quickly, we're almost out of time, but I did want to ask you, when you look at this problem, aside from getting these voluntary agencies out of the business and trimming the numbers of refugees that are brought in, starting with these guys in these Australian detention camps, it would seem to me, the president's talking about admitting 45,000 more of them, but there was talk during the campaign, as you know, Anne, about having an extreme vetting process. I haven't heard anything about that lately, but I and several of our colleagues put together an amicus brief for the Supreme Court arguing that we need a filter for Sharia supremacism. Would that make sense to you in terms of trying to damage limit here?
It does make sense to add it, but let me just say, how do you screen somebody? Let's take these Australian failed asylum seekers who failed to get into Australia now in detention. How do you screen somebody who got on a boat? There is no way to screen these people. The screening, by the way, on these Australians is less than 12 months, and we've been told it was 18 to 24 months. So how do you even begin to screen somebody? Let's say Syria, they've left Syria. There's no way you can call back to Syria and say, hey, let's have some information on, you know, this particular family. There's nothing to screen with.
Well, this is a huge problem. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it argues again for not allowing these folks in. We have to leave it at that. Anne Corcoran, thank you so much, really from the bottom of my heart, for the great work you do at Refugee Resettlement Watch. Please check out her video and her book at securefreedom.org. Let's put her over the 3 million mark and help support the great work that Anne does tirelessly at Refugee Resettlement Watch. Come back to us again soon if you would, Anne. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.